I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Adam Tranter.
I'm Ned Bolting.
And I'm Laura Laker.
And Laura has a book out. It's called Potholes and Pavements, a bumpy ride on Britain's National Cycle Network, and is published by Bloomsbury on the 9th of May. And by some amazing fortune, we've been able to secure Laura Laker herself, the author, to interview. Yeah, we've had to pull a few strings, but we've managed it. Laura is doing a mini book tour, and we thought it would be great to dedicate an episode to this great book which Laura has written. And we have Ned's read all of it, I've read half of it, gonna read
I've
the
read
other half
of it
soon.
You've read all of it
many
loud,
times
actually. I read it out loud for the audiobook.
Oh, yeah. Audiobook is available.
yes. So but first of all, Laura, like, just well done. This is amazing. I now know two authors, Ned and Laura. This is incredible. So it's brilliant. I really enjoyed it. But first of all, personally, how's it been, the process of writing a book and everything that went into it?
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a roller coaster, I think. When I first got the book deal, it was very exciting, quite emotional, because I've been doing this writing about cycling for a long time, and I wanted to write a book for quite
10
a while.
Years.
Yes.
Well, a bit more now.
Yeah.
Like when you started writing a book, it was 10 years, wasn't it? As you'd say in one of the first chapters.
August 2012, I went freelance full time. I quit my last temping job. And then you're faced with this large task, which Ned will know well, of actually writing it. thankfully, I had to do like quite a good brief about what I was going to do where, and it was geographically kind of shaped. So there was a story attached to each area in my mind, and that ended up working out quite well. And then there was a long research a lot of traveling, which was amazing fun. It's basically like you feel like a proper writer and you're sort of traveling around, sitting in a pub at night making notes. I felt like a proper author. It's quite fun. And then this big research part, which was just a little bit overwhelming. Then what do you choose? And the bit I really liked was making it sound nice at the end, just like tweaking the words, sitting at I've got this old bureau, sitting there and making it sound as nice as I could. So yeah, it was a long old process. It's been 2 years in the making, two and a bit years in the making.
Yeah, books take a long time, don't they?
They do.
What I love about this book is it holds two things in balance. You know, it's on the one hand, it's your physical journey, which I particularly enjoy. I think you've got a really, I'm going to pick some little bits out and embarrass you by reading them back to you. I think you've got a beautiful way of describing, in quite an amusing way at times as well, the lived experience of just riding a bike and this, as you say, the bumpy ride across the country. So that's one side of the book, and it at times gets quite personal as well. But you know, equally importantly, they both prop each other up, I think, the different sides, is your acribic research into the history of the National Cycle Network, sustrans and all that. You really have written the, I would imagine, not that I'm well versed in this, the definitive account. Yeah.
I mean,
you've gathered all the strands together and you've analysed where we're at today, but also delved back into how it all came about. And was that always the plan to do those two things and hold them in one book? Or did that kind of emerge as you addressed the project?
It's funny, actually. I don't know the word acribic. That's the new one on me.
I may have misused
it. Might not even be a word.
I'm sure you haven't.
Yeah. I think it means a forensic attention to detail.
Okay,
thank you. I may be wrong.
Thanks. Well, thanks for the kind words. That means a lot because I love your books and writing.
This is great, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, if you'd written a book, Adam, we you could join in this mutual
as well.
We'd love your book as well.
Oh, guys. Yeah. So actually, when I was started writing it, people were saying, oh, is it going to be a history of sustrans? And I was quite sure at the time it wasn't going to be because I didn't necessarily think that was relevant.
It's quite niche, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of niche. But then the more I looked at it and the more I spoke to people who were there at the time and just came to understand what a gigantic undertaking this was, this creation of something from an idea to a reality through basically volunteers, people who either paid very little or nothing, to create something with a national scope and just enormous amounts of organisation and bringing people together. And it was a really kind of a bit of a people-powered miracle to my mind. And I just thought, what an incredible story. And it ended up being one of the bits I was most proud of, actually, because to be able to, being able to sort of draw those stories together and try and create a narrative was a challenge that I really enjoyed. And I just think it's such a fantastic story. And like you said, it hasn't really been told elsewhere. There's one book called Millennium Miles, which sustrans produced themselves and published. But it's very much a kind of a charity produced book. It's got lots of lovely pictures and it's got the story, but it doesn't necessarily, I don't know, it just, the sort of texture of it's very different from, I think, a book of this sort.
Yeah. Well, this is immensely, immensely readable, isn't it? And you mentioned earlier that, and I think it's one of the first things you say, that it kind of, when you signed the book contract and started embarking on the project, it was marked sort of 10 years since the summer of 2012 when you'd went freelance and started to, occupy the space that you do, the respected position of writing, in particular about cycling, but active travel. But also, I think I'm right in saying it was 45 years, pretty much to the year, since the National Cycle Work Network started.
Yeah, roughly. And there's lots of different kind of ideas. And sustrans and the founders of sustrans were always quite good at sort of having different anniversaries, depending on which year it was and what they were talking about, because there was a year they first got together as what was then Cycle Bag at the beginning, and then the year that they first did a bit of the Bristol to Bath railway path, and then when sustrans was founded. And so there's lots of different, but it has been, I guess, about probably 45 years.
It's really multifaceted as a book, because I'm probably in the category of people that would read the history of sustrans, which
it's a good history, as it turns out.
It is genuine. I learned a lot that I thought I would know about, and I just didn't know. But then, for people who aren't like me, which is many people, there are all these bits. It's like travel writing. I felt like I was traveling across Britain, and everybody is probably not in the whole book, but everyone's probably got an element of the book. I went there, I remember, it's great that that's there.
That's very true.
And then there's this kind of overall sort of predicament, I would say, that is really the crux of the point that you make a lot, which is, why is a charity running a piece of national infrastructure, and couldn't it be so much better funded or better, surfaced or without barriers and all of these things? And telling those stories in a way which is quite nerdy policy stuff, but in a way that people would go, oh, actually, this is something that affects us all, I think so. I think it's really, really, really good. And I enjoyed I enjoyed learning about it, really.
Oh, thank you.
Laura, I just want to sort of like stumble through a few things that stood out for me, on actually just the other day, rereading the book. And I think I'm going to say the first journey that you undertake in this book, because it's made up of all these little journeys and over a course of at least a year, and the various characters that you meet, including Chris Boardman, which I find very funny because I can hear, I can absolutely hear Chris Boardman's voice in that. I'm just trying to find page 6. Forgive me, I'm not very good at using these PDFs because I didn't get a proper paper copy of the book.
There is one in the post to you next week.
There is one in the post. But take me back to this point in your life where one of the first journeys that you describe, if not the first one, is a journey you make to go and find the start of Route One with an ex-boyfriend. Not a boyfriend any longer, but an ex-partner of yours. And at that point in your life, and this is just a sample, I thought this really stuck out because I want our listeners to realise how good the writing is here. You were at quite a low point in your life. You were a bit broke. You had a roof emergency that you needed to pay for, right? So if you bear with me, I just want to read this paragraph back because I think it's a terrific bit of writing. The roof emergency had left my bank account at the edge of its overdraft, so I said yes to every bit of work I could. The deadlines kept rolling in and I kept meeting them, if not quite on time, then forgivably close. In the evenings, I'd paint the attic walls and put up wallpaper, listening to podcasts about self-care and compassion. From the start of the year onward, my heart thumped in my chest, accompanied by a constant sense of rising dread, and things stayed that way for months. I'd wake up at 3 or 4 a.m., not knowing where I was, my heart racing, and lay there for hours unable to sleep. Occasionally, in a daze, this is such a killer line. Occasionally, in a daze, I'd catch sight of myself in a mirror looking, as P.G. Wodehouse would have described it, like an owl with a secret sorrow. Is that a P.G. Wodehouse quote?
Well, he quite often, actually, in his writing, describes various people as various animals with a secret sorrow. And I just thought it was the most wonderful description. And
you nicked it and stuffed it in your book. It's great.
With a citation. Yeah, I mean, I'm laughing. It was a very difficult time in my life, and it coincided with the start of the book. But I love P.G. Wodehouse's writing, and I did. It was a very difficult time. But like I said in the book, it was, you know, getting out on the bike at times like these is so important for me, because you can just really fester and, you know, at difficult points. And just being out in nature, there's such a kind of healing capacity. And it's something that I continue to kind of rediscover every time I've been ill or I'm feeling a bit low or, you know, and it just has this marvellous. So it's kind of a journey of healing. My sister actually didn't like that bit and thought I should take it out because it was too emotional.
Well, I mean, I love that. I'm a sucker for all that because I think it gives real context and heart to the book. You know, I think it's incredibly important. I think you do it with a very light touch. Actually, you don't. It's not indulgent. It's not, but it's very important.
That's good to hear.
It's very important because we need to buy into you as our narrator, as our guide through this. You know, what could be in the wrong hands, potentially quite a dry story, comes to life because we identify with you, and it's really important. You know, I've been doing this podcast with you for nearly 4 years. But there's loads of stuff I didn't realize about you. You know, and I particularly valued, and I think your readers will, your journey home to Somerset, where you tell us a little bit about your backstory, your family story. Yeah. I didn't realize you'd lost your dad quite young. Mm. He was 49, I think, when he died of a heart attack, wasn't he? But in his past before that, he'd had a pretty bad bike accident, hadn't he? I mean, so some of that is very personal stuff. Must be quite raw. I'm sure it wasn't easy in the retelling for either you or your sister.
Yeah.
Was that, again, sort of subject matter that you hesitated over?
Yeah, because I mean, like you said, I didn't want it to feel self-indulgent. But then at the same time, I did feel like it was important to tell this story because it was, you know, his experience ended up being part of my experience, as these things do. And this kind of event which happened, this collision which happened when he was a kid, basically, which had an impact on his whole life, actually.
It sounds like it did.
It kind of echoed through. And I, you know, as I was writing the book, I sort of came to realize actually that this perhaps had an impact on what I'm now doing today, and a kind of desire to fix something that I felt wasn't right. And my sister and I discussed it, and some early drafts were a bit too much.
Right.
But I think that's
your
normal.
Your sister was one of your editors, was she?
She's great, actually.
Which is a big character in the book as well. She pops up in Scotland, doesn't she, when you both go and visit Glasgow. And and then she's part of the Somerset story as well, where you come from.
Yeah, and we're very close these days. And I respect her opinion, and she's always going to be honest. That's the great thing about siblings.
Yeah, sometimes they can be too honest.
Too honest, yeah. she helped me with some of the facts, and our memories are different of certain events, as these things are. Memory is quite subjective. I did feel it was important. I read something actually about how female authors tend to do this, about, you know, bringing a personal element into a non-fiction book, and it's something about, I don't know, kind of validating our experiences or saying maybe we're not the expert. And it kind of made me reading that after I'd written the book made me question it. But I do think, like you say, it's such a dry topic. And I think we easily forget that road danger, road collisions impact people's lives. And it's not just the deaths, it's the injuries that people then live with throughout their lives that then have an effect not just on them, but on their families. And, you know, it's good to get beyond the stats, I think, and to understand what, you know, what these things cause. It's not just a momentary thing. It's, you know, it sort of has echoes.
Well, I'm a big fan of writing nonfiction like that, because that's a little bit how I write my nonfiction. I put myself in the frame, I write it in the first person, and I try and take the reader on that journey with me. And not as literally as you're doing in this book, because your journey is so literal in so many ways. Again, one of your really early journeys, that you go to Hereford, you end up going to meet up with John Grimshaw.
Yeah.
You can explain who he is in a second. And a lady called Isabel Stoddart.
Yep.
Who's obviously central to the kind of early days of Sustrans as well. And some brilliant advice that I think I'm right in saying John Grimshaw gave to Isabel about when they were trying to spread the message and kind of like go into meetings in local authorities to try and really, in the early days, kind of set out their agenda, get people on board, do all the stuff that Adam does, actually, you know, winning over hearts and minds at kind of decision-making level.
Yeah.
And one of the best bits of advice coming from John Grimshaw was, don't look like cyclists when you're going into these meetings. And I thought that could have been written in 2024 because that bit hasn't changed.
Yeah.
But set it in context, because we think, you know, we've often spoken about it, haven't we, on this podcast nowadays, that cycling is a kind of weird, gnarly minority pursuit, that we're trying to change that. But that's nothing today compared to what it was obviously like back in 1977 when it all got underway.
Yeah, it was super weird. And I mean, the point at which Isabel Stoddart got involved is initially she ended up doing some kind of a very long ride and then getting Sustrans as her, you know, charity to which she'd raise money and donate to.
She's the one who went from Dover to Inverness or something like that. Yeah.
She organised a mass ride.
That's right.
And I can't remember if Alexis Sale was on one of these rides, because his photo's in this Millennium Miles book. So he was on one of the early trailblazing rides.
How brilliant.
Yeah. So he was a supporter from back in the day, you know, with the 90s t-shirts.
And, yeah.
So this would have been the 90s by this point, when they've had this idea for a national cycle network. They're trying to get the funding. And cycling was very weird. I mean, in the 70s, John said you knew every cyclist in Bristol. There were that few. You know, you probably knew them by name.
Also, they named their organisation Cycle Bag.
Yeah. Which stood for Channel Your Calf and Leg Energy into Bristol, or Bicycle Action Group, depending on who you are.
No, it didn't.
You
did it really? So they came up with a word, cycle bag, and then had to retrofit what it means.
I don't even
That's
know.
Absolutely
can
brilliant.
You imagine the meeting?
Yeah.
It's like
what
people
it mean?
With a head in their hands.
What words begin with Y? Very good.
Yeah. But yeah, they would go to these meetings, and John would, I mean, he's a great raconteur. He tells a great story. He's very charismatic, and he would go into these councils and basically get people to change their minds.
Yep.
He would paint this picture about, you know, what if we could cycle for daily journeys instead? And a lot of this stuff, like you say, could have come from today.
Yep.
And he wanted it to be normal and was quite a visionary in that way. And, you know, there were lots of people involved. Isabel Stoddart was just one, but there were, you know, there was... yeah, just so many people. I've got the most enormous acknowledgements
Mark Strong was another significant character of that era. Yeah,
and I met George Platts after writing the book, who kind of did a lot of their public kind of performance pieces. So they did a giant bicycle made of people and bikes in Castle Park in Bristol as a kind of protest. And he is an artist, and that was his thing. They did musical instruments on your bike and all sorts of kind of public participation activities, which made things fun. And they had all these different people with all these different backgrounds and all tried to get together and under this same idea.
I'm just looking at the blurb, which I also love and really highlights what this is all about.
Did you provide a quote for the cover?
I didn't, actually. I'm just looking through. There's, I mean, Will Norman's on there. London's walking cycle.
Did you not approach Adam for a quote?
Although it does say here that Laura hosts the Streets Ahead podcast with Adam Trant and Ned Bolton.
Oh, that's
so
good.
We got a name check. Oh, you're on the front cover. Look at that. Ned Bolton.
Oh, there you go.
But
with Jeremy Vine.
Yeah,
with Jeremy Vine. Me and Jez.
Me and Jezza.
On the same page as ever.
Yeah, always on the same page.
Always on the same page.
Yeah. He's in a pod. Looking at this, we've got what's gone right and wrong with this piece of national infrastructure. And the point that you make, that you go into further in the book and people can read about it, is that this is a network run by a charity whose CEO once admitted, we've had enough of it being crap, we need to fix it.
Yeah.
When you were out there and riding, because you saw the danger, some of it was maddening, it just stops in the middle of nowhere, sometimes you get shoved onto a main road. But then obviously you meet all these great people and the great potential for it. Was it hard to stay positive, and did you leave thinking more like we are on the cusp of this being nearly very good and could be, or that we are so far from this?
Just before you let Laura answer that, I've got another little quote, another paragraph from Laura's book that highlights exactly the point that you've just flagged up. There's a recurring theme in Laura's writing. I can't remember which ride this is. Oh, you're riding through Kent somewhere near Canterbury. I'm trying to enjoy the ride, but I keep getting distracted by the details, the frustrations, the time spent getting lost, the inconvenience and discomfort of sharing roads with drivers who don't seem aware of how scary it is being overtaken too close, close passing, as it's known, at speed. The National Cycle Network, I realise, follows a pattern. Glorious stretches of rural road and former railway paths that are a puzzle to find from their nearest train stations. If the signage isn't throwing you for a loop in built-up areas, there's a fierce dance of pavements, roads, odd-shaped anti-motorcycle barriers, and a maze of back streets requiring constant vigilance to avoid missing one of the tiny blue direction signs. And that's a pretty good description, I think, of most people's experience. And that is what Xavier Bryce was saying when he said, let's face it, a lot of it's a bit crap.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that was a brave admission on his part.
Very much so.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a Ratner's moment, perhaps. A Gerald Ratner. Does that predate you, your experience?
Sure.
It's the guy that said his watches were crap, right?
Yeah, he owned a brand of jewellers called Ratner's.
Oh, gosh.
And he said, we just sell a load of crap.
Oh, no. And that was the end of that.
And that was the end of that.
Right. But I think when Xavier said that, I think what he perhaps realised was that people know this to be the case. I mean, people get quite angry at Sustrans. And I can understand their frustration, but also I can see it from Sustrans' side and the limited funds and the total lack of power they have to change things without the landowner's permission, because they own less than 5% of the network. But I think people really respected it when he said that. I think he maybe didn't mean to say it as he did. But it's sort of stuck, hasn't it? But it's really stuck. But, you know, he said there was such a positive response from their members and people who cycled on the network saying, thank goodness someone has acknowledged it's problematic. Like, we love this network. There's amazing bits to it, but there's also bits that are terrible. And he wanted it not just to be a story about, you know, this is a, you know, it's got problems, but actually isn't this a wonderful thing in many parts and in terms of an idea? And let's try and fix it. And he kind of had this vision to, you know, improve lots of different bits, because quite often it's a small bit that needs fixing to get a good bit into the town centre, or, you know, connect up good bits to one another. And, you know, they've been quite successful at doing that in patches. And then the funding runs out once again. And there's this kind of roller coaster ride that Sustrans has to go through pretty much every year. And yeah, and just try and keep on keeping on, which is...
I think you describe it as a zero gravity moment in their annual annual fiscal cycle, where they don't know what next year is going to look like.
Exactly.
Year on year. And that doesn't sound conducive to kind of medium long-term planning with any degree of consistency, does it?
And it takes like 3 years to build a cycle route. You need 1 year to think about it and design it, second year to consult and tweak it, get the permissions, and then third year to build it. And if you don't have that multi-year funding, I mean, Sustrans gets this money and it just gets to kind of patch a little bit, or and it can't do any strategic planning because of this lack of long-term funding, which must be hugely frustrating for them. But they've managed to do a lot with a little, but I think ultimately they are limited by, you know, being a charity and not having the funding and the power of a government body like National Highways or Network Rail, say.
So there's some startling stuff when you write about National Highways versus not just Sustrans, but also Active Travel England and all that sort of thing. So National Highways Agency has 6,000 permanent staff members who work for them. Active Travel England, at the last count, 98.
Yeah.
But the most startling example you come up with was, I think it's somewhere in Cornwall, there's been a new stretch of dual carriageway enhanced or built, or some works have been done to it. And as part of that process, National Highways have presumably to kind of tick a box. Not that it's not the right thing to do. They've planted 500,000 trees over a 21-mile stretch of this dual carriageway that they've just been working on. But they've done it so badly that within a couple of years, the trees are all dead.
All dead.
I mean, that's just the saddest thing. And then you've worked out that they have just wasted effectively nearly £3 million, which is the annual budget for the National Cycle Network, thereabouts. Have I told that story right?
I think so. And the numbers off the top of my head, but it's really tragic. And I mean, the thing about planting trees, you need to look after them. Mm. I think 40% of street trees die once they've been planted, and many of those are watered. And it's just, you know, you can't just bung a tree in the ground and then hope for the best. But yeah, it's just, I think it's just gives you a sense of just the scale of what they're dealing with and how much resource they have. And just the frustration that you'd feel knowing the huge benefit of walking and cycling and the very questionable benefits of trunk roads, that this is the way things are allocated. And yeah, I really try. And I mean, the more I looked into it, the more shocking I found it. Mm. And you just think, is this really what we want to be spending our limited funds on, given we've got an environmental crisis and a health public health crisis and all of these problems? And, you know, wouldn't it be great if we spent this money on cycling instead?
And even if we... let's just say we didn't, and we thought road building was like a really good idea and we should keep doing it. What, you know, the idea that while they're there, they can't put a bit of a path down the side using the corridor of land that they've taken. No. Similar to the thing we talk about, the HS2 stuff.
HS2, yeah.
It, you know, it's such small money compared to compared to the actual general project, and can really reduce that sort of severance that often these projects create.
But you describe it, at one point in the book, you go to the Netherlands, don't you, very briefly, and kind of like you don't dwell on it because it's just so painful, the comparison. but at one point you describe, I think I'm right in saying, quite a long ride alongside a motorway
in
a kind of endlessly long flat. That's how I imagine it, with a motorway hammering past. But an amazing kind of like bit of infrastructure.
They wouldn't think to not do that.
Yeah,
would they?
It's the dam that keeps the sea out of the Netherlands, basically.
Yeah. So was it very windy as
well? Yeah, it's incredibly. There's sort of tumbleweed. It's sort of tumbleweed. It's so
weird.
Well,
you know, they have the national headwind racing championships on the Dutch coast.
It was cancelled recently.
It was too windy.
It
was too windy. They had to cancel it. Yeah, a friend of mine who's Dutch calls it the existential headwind in the Netherlands, because you can be riding along and you think you're in the headwind. You ride and you turn 90 degrees and you think, oh, thank goodness, it's headwind again. How is it possible?
London can be a bit like that. Last few days have been so windy. I'm thinking, where is this wind coming from? Oh, it's every direction today, is it? Brilliant. So going back to the sort of like the experience of riding this route. Off the top of my head, I mentioned Hereford. You ride through Kent. Mm-hmm. You ride, one of your first rides is with your friend Becky.
Yeah.
And you ride from the Medway into London, do you go? I can't remember.
No, we go from Gravesend sort of out towards an RSPB reserve, like a wetlands
reserve.
And you
have a picnic.
And we have a little picnic.
And it's a lovely day, but it starts off with a kind of typically underwhelming National Cycle Network experience of the deadly alleyway.
The atmospheric alley,
that's right, which marks the beginning of the route. And you find it, and it really is quite atmospheric.
It's terrifying. And it's barred at one end, and you feel like kind of trapped. And it's so narrow, you can't actually turn the bike around without putting it on its back wheel and pivoting it. Amazing. Yeah, that was very funny.
I'm curious, because this is effectively, it's the best advert possible for better funding of such trends, but also you highlight that there are lots of flaws with the system as well, and with Sustrans themselves. I'm intrigued as to your sort of Sustrans think this is a good thing. Like, you know, do they think, you know, what's the relationship like? Have they even read it? You know, like that kind of thing. So
The few people in Sustrans have read it. Xavier Bryce has read it, and a couple of his team in the press department, and a couple of others. They don't like the title. They think it's too negative. But I felt that we agonized over the title for a long time. I was very worried about it for a while, but we felt that having something like this is kind of grabby and it gets people's attention. I didn't want it to seem like it was an advert for Sustrans. Quite a few people asked me if it was a Sustrans book that I was writing. And so I didn't want it to seem that way. And also, I just didn't want it to seem like it was just going to be a la-di-da, isn't everything wonderful book, because I wanted it, you know, it's a State of the Nation book. So I think that Xavier feels that it's fair and warm. I mean, like you say, it's very positive about the positive bits of the National Cycle Network. Where we disagree is who should be running it. And we're going to have a discussion about this in Bristol in May, which is on my website. I think it's the 23rd of May.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, thank you. And
so what do you mean, who should be running it?
Yeah, so I think and have seen through my research and what I've experienced riding, that having a national piece of infrastructure run by a charity just doesn't work. they don't have the money or the power. You know, those are the two most important things when you're building a cycle route or any kind of infrastructure. You need the money, you need the power, because landowners are going to be reluctant and things are going to take time and, you know, planning is needed and multi-year, you know, all of this. And Sustrans doesn't have any of that. And where I think they're great is in the delivery side. So talking to communities and then being the people doing the infrastructure, like building the infrastructure, but it needs to be run and managed by a national body, strategic, and then linking up to local routes, which local councils, regional bodies would deliver.
So like, are you saying effectively take it into the state? So it should mimic in terms of its powers the National Highways Agency, in the sense that National Highways Agency can push projects through by using levers like compulsory purchase orders, etc. What's the rationale for that not being applicable to cycling? Is that your point?
Well, Xavier would say that having it in the hands of a charity is escaping some of the culture wars element and the fact that it's not the government taking this piece of land or, you know, making a cycle. It's a charity at kind of delivering on its charitable aims.
Interesting.
And I think it's, you know, he makes a good point.
There's some merit in that argument.
Yeah, it's a good point. But, you
doesn't
know,
take what, cycling that serious. Sorry, I've thought about biting my tongue then, but I've got to say it. Doesn't sort of take cycling seriously, though, does it? If we're just sort of not wanting to upset anybody or not wanting to, or we wouldn't want to see it like a serious project, so we'll
no, but as a positive,
as a tactic,
attribute,
it's not scalable tactic, though.
Right. Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, and as we know, once things are built, a lot of the anti-sentiment goes away.
Yeah.
People see, oh, this is actually a positive thing because, you know, it's safe for kids. I can get from A to B. I don't have to drive. This is brilliant. People are using it.
The Anne Hidalgo paradigm.
Yeah.
That's what we call it.
Yeah, it's very much.
Yeah.
And yeah, people find it really hard to imagine what something's going to be like until it's there. You know, the streets have always been the same way. The roads in the countryside have always been managed in the same way. We don't have that template of, if we have a road, we should also have a cycle route in between two places. And we're such a compact country. Lots of our settlements are very close together. Market towns were traditionally a sort of day's walk or pony ride apart. And, you know, this is easily cyclable distances and it makes total sense. So, yeah, there's differing opinions, but I do believe that, you know, both things can exist. It's just that if we're going to have this delivery and have it in any sort of rapidity, any sort of scale, then it needs to be taken into, you know, government hands and run and managed like a national piece of infrastructure, which it is and should be. Most of our journeys are short.
Plucking from kind of like thin air here, but an example of how that might look actually on the ground would be if you take, I grew up in Bedfordshire, right? Mm. So Bedford's maybe 10 miles from Great Barford or something like that. And you know, people do. Well, maybe 10 miles is a bit too much. Let's talk about
5 miles.
Five miles.
Your book says something like 71%.
5 miles, somewhere 5 miles away where people do, regularly have to go to. So giving them the option of using a bicycle would involve potentially purchasing a strip of land off a bunch of farmers whose land adjoins adjoins that main road. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Yeah, there's a couple to widen
the road sufficiently to build one of these Dutch kind of proper paths.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways of doing it. There's a kind of, you could have like a, someone's described to me as Beyond the Hedgerow Act, which I quote in the book, which would be, you know, if you've got a trunk road, say, like the A27 in East Sussex, which is, the National Highways have built a lovely cycle path beyond the hedgerow there. And you could deliver, you know, it wouldn't have to be right next to the road, so it would feel safe and it wouldn't be noisy and smelly. And it would be like riding through the countryside. It'd be great. Or you can do a series. You can kind of do like a low traffic neighbourhood treatment in the countryside where you can have through roads and access roads and filter certain rural roads. So that's another way of doing it, and that's a lot cheaper. There's existing bridleways and footways that could be widened or
upgraded generally.
Or it could be just if there's no other options, it could just be a path along a main road that's protected by curbs and maybe some kind of trees. So yeah, there's lots of different options.
I mean, some of that stuff is stuff that Sustrans have been doing. Some of it's not, you know, that kind of like that element of...
I'm sure they've done all of this, to be honest. Maybe not the, probably not the purchase of land beyond the hedgerow because they don't have that powers.
That feels like a huge potential shift in what would be possible if that were ever politically available.
Alongside railway land as well. That's another big one because Network Rail owns a lot of the, like National Highways owns a lot of the land alongside roads.
Yeah.
Network Rail owns a lot of very flat land alongside railway tracks, but they're quite protective, especially of their bridges. So you have to be careful.
Yeah, Sustrans, you know, they've been going for so long, as you say, and they've had so much experience in doing this. They are, you know, very much the authority on this. And I think the opportunity there is like how you take that and you scale it, because they are very clear for, even from the early days, that they are brilliant at overcoming adversity and trying to find a solution to a problem.
And their staff are amazing. They really care.
Totally. And it very much comes from even just the way they built their first path, and, you know, the way that they, it's just ingenious the way that they did it. Now, the problem is when it gets hard, they don't have a card to play. And that's where Ned's point about maybe compulsory purchase orders. I mean, okay, sure, we'll do it this way. But if it gets hard, it means that we can do it if we need to. And, you know, when you bring it into the state, as you say, you know, local authorities have those power, combined authorities, some of them have those powers, National Highways have those powers, because for a reason, because sometimes the scope and the scale of the project, you know, outweighs the negatives, and it needs to be managed properly. But those kind of tools would be super interesting. And I think the only thing I'd say is, on top of that, though, you do need that political will, because Sustrans describe themselves as a custodian of the National Cycle Network, and I think that's very genuine. Because let's just give an example, a very real example. National Highways are technically the custodians of old railway bridges, for example, and rather than having a strategy to actually build off-road cycle routes, they just filled them in with concrete. So that's literally what they did.
Yeah, railway tunnels.
Yeah, railway tunnels and road bridges would go over. So even when there's a path where Sustrans have gone, we've got our eye on that, we can make a path there, you can do something for really public good.
Yeah,
they sort of rather fill it in and get it off their liability than any of those things. So you have to have something above that saying, this is what we should be doing.
Yeah.
I think that's missing, and that needs careful consideration, because it could be that, you know, you think something like, let's roll Sustrans into National Highways, that sounds sensible. And then you realise that actually there isn't that will to change anything.
There's a cultural issue. Yeah, National Highways were tasked with, they called it the burdensome estate, these old railway bridges that were basically ended up in public hands after the beaching cuts, when lots of the railways got cut in the 1960s. And so, National Highways ended up, and their mandate was to just make them safe, and they interpreted that as pouring concrete in them so they could never fall down.
It's one way of making them.
It's so interesting. Just to return to your book and the experience of riding and some of the people you met, you really enjoy riding the Camel Trail.
Love the Camel.
Which is down in Cornwall.
Yeah, pretty good.
But to get from Bodmin Parkway Station to Bodmin, where it begins, involves you taking...
hard.
19 wrong turns in 5 miles. I don't know whether that's an author's license to exaggerate or whether you were counting.
I counted them.
19
wrong
turns.
Yeah.
That's sort of Eden Project land down there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Down there, yeah.
And did you know?
That's nearly 4 wrong turns every mile, Laura.
I could have almost walked it faster than I ended up cycling it. I took so many wrong turns. And yet, the Camel Trail is the second most popular tourist attraction, often that doesn't make the top 10 tourist attraction list, in Cornwall, only beaten by the Eden Project.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was also a blessed relief to you, because the rest of Cornwall is hilly, isn't it? Like Cornwall and Devon are just like, just chill out, just relax. As a topography, isn't it? I don't know why you have to be all scrunched up. I got a friend called Simon who's got very scrunched up ears. Yeah. And we always used to tease him when we were young about, just tell your ears to relax. And Devon and Cornwall are a bit like that. They're too scrunched up.
They're
just chill.
So
be a bit more Norfolk.
Up. Oh, my goodness.
You also ride the Wandle Trail with Isabel Clement of Wheels for Wellbeing. Being. And, and that's very educational as well, because it teaches you stuff about the National Cycle Network that is invisible to you, being an able-bodied rider. Right?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, Isabel's amazing. She's got this hand cycle, so she has a wheelchair that she uses, and then she attaches this third wheel with a kind of set of pedals, which she cranks with her hands. And so it turns her into a tricycle, and it's electric assisted, so she's motorized. But then the thing with being in a wheelchair and just the nature of the wheelchair and the nature of the tricycle and being so low to the ground, sat in a chair, is that any kind of imperfection on the road or surface or any camber, any slope on the road really affects you.
Hugely exaggerated by the wheels that you're riding.
And you can very easily,
So if we think, if able-bodied cyclists think that the National Cycle Network is occasionally challenging, then it must be so much harder.
You can so easily get tipped out of a wheelchair, and it's terrifying. And so we rode parts of the Wandle Trail. We had to get there first, and any kind of divot in the road, she has to really negotiate around. It's constant vigilance. It's like you think you need to be vigilant on a bicycle.
It's a wonder you had any time to actually talk.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, she's amazing. We did sit down at the end and have a chat in the cafe, but a lot of it was en route. And then there was this one particularly bad bridge, which was basically made up of railway sleepers over a ditch. I joke you not, it was like 10 railway sleep, maybe not even 10. And then there was just a muddy bank either side of this little stream, little grubby little stream. And they've built
that
since...
Was that the River Wandle?
It might have been the grubby little
grubby
stream.
Little stream.
Sorry, Wandle. It just seemed like it was very... It just was a very bad crossing. And it made me kind of angry, because watching Isabel negotiate this thing made me quite... Anyway, there's a beautiful bridge over it now. It's nice and smooth, and they've resurfaced a lot of it because it was gravel. And so, that's her favourite place. But she can't go down there because of the mud, the lack of hard surface. She can't go down there for 2 weeks after it's rained. And just imagine in the UK, I mean, we've had a couple of hot summers, but for the large part...
Yeah, two or three days a year.
Mm. Yeah.
How mad. You go to Scotland and your e-bike called Lola? No, Lucy. No, what's
Lily.
Lily, that's right. Lily, your e-bike.
I didn't name her, but she's named Lily, yeah.
What do you mean?
It's
got Lily on the frame? Or
yeah, there's a little sticker that says Lily on the
battery. So someone else named her Lily.
Someone else named the previous owner.
Yeah. Anyway, she'd been your loyal companion through Cornwall and places like that, Kent. On your way to Euston to catch a train up to Scotland, she stopped working.
Yeah.
So you had to sort of load a broken e-bike onto the train and take her all the way up to Scotland.
Yeah, it was quite stressful.
It was one of those annoying ones that you have to hang from the ceiling as well.
Would it have been? No, I think it was the Pendolino.
Bike torture cupboards. Okay, they're okay.
No, hang on, it's the West Coast. What would it have been?
Yeah, it would have been a GWR train. No,
on the
GWR.
West Coast.
West Coast Mainline. Mm. Oh, it would have been a Avanti, sorry.
To Glasgow.
Yeah, you'd be
what
fine.
What are they like?
They're okay.
You just wheel them in, I have had to dangle her from a hook before, because she weighs 25 kilos.
That's
she's quite
thing,
a
yeah.
piece of equipment. And because she's so, like, the frame's so stiff, so basically the sacrificial part is the plastic battery. So over time, it just rattles itself dead basically, and it's quite an expensive part.
So
I went up to Scotland with this dead e-bike, wondering how on earth I'm going to do a cycling trip with a broken bicycle. I went to various bike shops. No one knew how to fix it. They were saying you're gonna have to go halfway across the country to Stirling to find the one bike shop that serves Whisper, the brand. And then Carlton Reed, among others, said you have to go to this one bike shop, Kinetics Glasgow.
Little plug for them.
Yeah, they're amazing, Ben. So I got there and it said, we don't do bike repairs, go to e-bike love them. Because I'd basically called up every e-bike shop in Scotland, it felt, by this point. I knew that e-bike love was on holiday. So I knocked on Ben's door anyway, and he took pity on me and basically bent a couple of prongs. It was just a loose connection, bent a couple of prongs in the battery. But I'm always amazed when you take apart an e-bike battery, it's basically lots of AA batteries in a row all just taped together.
Is it?
Yeah. So
it
weird. Yeah.
Well, they're not. Yeah. They're like cells, aren't they? Of batteries.
But they literally are like...
With a casing.
Imagine,
on.
Yeah.
Well, I never.
So if you want more, more battery, you kind of just put more cells on it and then just put a case around it. So
yeah, super weird.
It's not rocket science, is it?
No.
You go to Froome, which I identified with, because you're in search with Richard A.
Ackroyd,
for the missing link of Froome.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard riding around Froome, isn't
God,
it?
God, it is.
I remember that. You remember on that 3-day trip to Minehead?
Oh my word, yes.
And I had to. And Froome was the end of day two, and it started to hail, and I was like really tired, and I came out of Froome the steep side, and it was one of the hardest little climbs out of there. You go and have a cup of coffee at the Cheese and Grain, which made me smile because I've performed at the Cheese
have
and Grain.
You?
Yeah, me and Paul McCartney.
I was about to say, Paul McCartney got a surprise gig before Glastonbury one year.
He did. It's a really nice venue, actually. Really
it's lovely.
Nice venue. You go to South Wales and ride around Cardiff. Yeah. This made me laugh a lot. You go to the Lake District and ride with Dave Shuttle.
Yeah.
Who's again a Sustrans character? I can't remember. Where's
Dave Sustrans, kind of Ranger.
Ranger. Sounds American, that, doesn't it? But
isn't Ranger?
But like a buffoon, really, Laura. I'm sorry to be so blunt with you, but you decide to do two things. One, go for this ride into the Lake District on the August bank holiday, where there isn't a blade of grass left in the Lake District that isn't kind of like being picnicked on by people from Chiswick. And you decide not to take your e-bike because the Lake District is famously flat, isn't it?
Yeah.
So well done. How was your day in the lakes?
It was amazing. I had a few days. It was delightful, actually. I cycled. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it's quite kind of nice, actually, after riding around on an e-bike a lot. It was quite nice to have a bit of a challenge of some hills.
Well, you're a strong bike rider anyway, aren't you?
I mean, you are. Sometimes. Yeah, yeah. It depends. I've been doing my squats. And also, after the Lake District, I was going to see Chris Boardman, and I felt like I was going to go and see Chris.
Now, need to practice.
We need to talk about Boardman. Well, we need to talk about a couple of people, beginning with B, actually. Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
You recount an encounter with him in 2015, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the only time I ever interviewed Boris Johnson as well, when he was London Mayor. Really? I think that was in 2015 as well. What impression did he make on you?
So I went to, like, a normal, like, you know, a state school and a kind of the worser of the two colleges in the nearest town.
Just like Boris Johnson.
Yeah, it's just
very similar.
Because, I mean, mainly because I was just rebelling at the time. But anyway, and then just a very ordinary university. And so I don't really know that many people who've lived such a privileged life. And I think seeing him at the side of the road, he was opening the first of his superhighway bike lanes on Vauxhall Bridge in 2015. And just seeing the people go driving by, flipping him the bird, shouting out of their window, because he's very recognisable, shouting out of their windows at him. And
what, abusive or supportive messaging?
Abusive, mostly abusive.
And he was quite a popular London mayor.
Did not care.
He was popular, yeah. Maybe it's because it was next to a cycle lane.
I mean, it was hard to
Maybe it's a cycle lane that wasn't,
it was hard to hear, but it seemed like a lot of it was quite negative. And he just did not care.
No.
It was astonishing.
There's something slightly disconnected about the caring bit, isn't there? Because I did a sit-down interview with him for ITV that spring, actually, or just before we went off to cover the Tour de France. Because that year, the tour started in Utrecht, which is, of course, you know, second only to Copenhagen, or even in excess of Copenhagen. I don't know. It's the cycling city, isn't it?
Great. None.
So we wanted to do, me and Chris, we wanted to do a piece on that for ITV's Tour de France coverage. And I was sent to go and interview Boris Johnson. And he turned up fashionably late. We'd set our camera crew up in City Hall with a kind of view of the city over the river, if you can imagine that, behind where he was going to sit down. And he arrived a little bit late, not too late, but a little bit late, and did the kind of not much eye contact sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then just for 10 minutes wouldn't sit down to kind of like get the interview started, because he just wanted to stand and gaze at the city saying, I did all this. He just said, all the sky. Because we're slightly off subject here, but he, I think I'm right in saying, during his mayoralty, whether it was him directly or not, an awful lot of 20-story plus skyscrapers went up.
The new buildings.
Yeah, and he was enormously proud of just how high-rise London was becoming. Look at this, Singapore, and all that. So it was weird because he wasn't talking to me. Mm. He was talking to himself in his own reflection in the glass.
Oh,
it was
rather
strange. But, you know, it's a well-versed story. He moved the dial in terms of London, and you have to credit him for that. You know.
Yeah.
The other bloke beginning with B is Chris Boardman.
Yeah.
And I loved, you go to the Wirral, which is, you know, where else are you going to actually talk to Chris Boardman other than the Wirral? There's two things I love. One is you take the train to Chester Station. And I can totally picture this. You're waiting outside Chester Station with your bike, presumably, for Chris to turn up. He's bang on time. But I can't actually envision Chester Station myself. I can't remember what it looks like, but I can visualise a kind of rectangular taxi rank sort of parking space area.
One way
thing outside for cars to drop people off and pick them up. And Chris arrives on his bike, and instead of sort of riding the obvious short distance, slightly illegally, just to say hello,
the
Laura.
The narrow end of the rectangle.
He goes all the way around three sides of the rectangle in order to absolutely obey the letter of the law. And you kind of laugh at him, and he says, all it takes is one person to take a picture of me doing something wrong, and I've been Daily Mailed.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was just such a Chris thing.
And then he takes
you on what you describe as a psychogeographical tour of the Wirral with Chris Boardman.
Yeah.
So you explore not only the geography of the tour, but the psychology of Chris Boardman.
Or what, at least his history.
What an arid subject that is. He's brilliant, isn't he?
He is brilliant. It was more about his kind of, because he's like, oh, I used to live there. Me and my wife used to live there.
Yeah,
and then,
above the chip shop.
I don't know if it was above a chip shop. It was by the water. It was on by the canal.
Yeah.
And then we went along the canal and then out on the Wirral on the estuary. And then there was a building he wanted Borman Bikes to buy at some point, but there was a weird building and he couldn't. And then he turns out he was going there on his lockdown rides, and it's like part of his 2-hour loop, his kind of exercise loop. Mm. And then, of course, you have all these men in Lycra who recognise him. And I thought it was quite sweet. I kept getting distracted by have they realised who he is yet? And they'd be like, oh, hello. And they do a little double take or make some sort of comment.
And he always goes, hello. But that, in that voice, he's like, hello. That voice. Very funny.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah.
But his relationship with the bike is very interesting, because I've witnessed this from the many professional cyclists that I have known who retire. Chris is no different, really, in that when they stop racing their bikes, which is a ferociously unpleasant experience, they have to go through this kind of like 5-year detoxification program, however informal, to kind of reconfigure their relationship with the bike.
Yeah.
And Chris, you know, absolutely fell into that category. I've seen it over time and time again that the last thing they ever want to do is ride a bike again.
Yeah.
So they chuck it to one side. And in Chris's case, you know, he wanted to carry on feeling fit and sort of on top of it. So he started running until an old ankle injury that he'd sustained racing the Tour de France prevented him from running anymore, which years later forced him back onto the bike. But now 3 or 4 years have passed and he's no longer even anywhere close to the level he had been when he left off. So he's now got to find a new way of relating to the bicycle. Mm. And it's been really lovely to watch him kind of like return to planet Earth.
To
come back and join the rest of us. And I think it's been lovely for him actually as well to kind of like, I think that's a particular journey that he's been on.
He shares lots of pictures of him cycling in various beautiful places.
Yeah.
He likes riding off road basically. He doesn't like going in traffic because it makes him, you know, it's quite stressful. And he just goes on his gravel bike and goes and explores in Scotland and has a wonderful time.
Well, he owns half of Scotland now, so
he's done very well.
He's done very well for himself, the boy. He's done all right. And just finally, I wanted to touch on the last thing I want to touch on. Right towards the end of the book, you basically drop a 10-point manifesto.
Yeah.
Right. Can you summarize it rather than going through every single 10-point? Or maybe you should.
Don't give it all away.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I don't want to. Laura Laker's 10-point manifesto.
Basically,
like Stalin's 5-year plan. Without the gulags.
There's a bicycle gulag, no. I don't know what that would look like. Basically, cycling's amazing is what I've been trying to say through the book. Isn't this a brilliant thing? Isn't it wonderful? Why aren't we spending more money on it? And this is how we get it to be, you know, what it could be and deliver all the wonderful things that cycling delivers. So, money and power, basically, and a few other things, and make it accessible for everyone, because, you know, to my mind, and I only underline this, all of my experience, it needs to be accessible for everyone. You know, people should have access to the outdoors without needing a special bike or special skills. And, you know, it's all possible. This is the thing. We've got all the everything we need. It's just a case of allocating our resources to it and going for it.
Cool. So the publication date is
May the 9th,
and it's out as an audiobook.
Yeah.
Starring Laura Laker as Laura Laker.
Yeah.
Very good.
I wanted to do that bit. I've always wanted to do a plug, like pretend I'm on Radio 4 or something.
Go on, you can do it as well.
Yeah.
So Potholes and Pavements, A Bumpy Ride on Britain's National Cycle Network is available in all good bookstores from May the 6th.
Ninth.
Duh. This is why I'm
imagine reading the audiobook, Adam. Just imagine it.
But you can pre-order it. If you listen to that after May the 9th, you can buy it. You can get the Kindle version.
Don't buy it on Amazon if you can possibly avoid it.
All good bookstores.
Yep.
And the bad ones.
And the bad ones too.
Try the good ones first.
There's an audiobook as well, which that's you get to hear a bit more of.
Hours of Laker.
Yeah. So go and buy the book.
Absolutely.
Do that.
Very, very, very good. You must be very proud. Aww, well done.
Thank you both. Yeah. This has really made me very happy. And hearing you reading bits of my book is lovely, Ned.
It's a very good book. It's a pleasure.
Yes. So you've been listening to Streets Ahead. If you'd like to leave us a review, that would be great. You do that in your podcast app. And also, why not tell a friend about what we do here and see if you can get them to listen too. Buy a copy of Laura's book. And we'll see you next time. From me, Adam Tranter, bye.
From me, Ned Bolton, goodbye.
From me, Laura Laker, goodbye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.